Let's see. Okay, before I forget, I better hand out. I do have device evaluations forms for you. Several of you have been asking me when I'm going to get to this assignment that's on my schedule. I'm planning on setting it up this afternoon, probably early. And it will be set up in our offices. As long as you call and make sure there's someone to open the door there, you can come in anytime between, you know, regular business hours between like 9 and 5. I will be there Tuesdays and Thursdays afternoons. And for this assignment, we'll make it due, what did I put on the web?
December 15th?
No, I didn't put December 15th on the web. I think it was actually November 14th.
Yeah,
is what I put on the web for this one. I have to see which device, which actual computer access system I will have set up. I want to check if there's one someone didn't sign up for that I really wanted people to see. And I'll pick that one. Otherwise, I'll grab another one off the shelf. We have so many to choose from for computer access things that gotta pick the right one. But I'll get that set up, and you can come in and do the little evaluation of that as well.
How long does it usually take?
I think it takes about an hour for people to go through the advertisements and look at the device. I'll send an email around with what device it is. You might be able to shortcut that by reading advertisements on the web or documentation on the web. And if you absolutely can't make it during business hours, we can talk about sometime in the evening or something like that. But that's always harder to set up since I like to go home. So staying to 6 isn't any great hardship for me. Okay, this is the first of 2 days we'll be talking about augmentative and alternative communication. And so first we're going to kind of talk about what is communication. And one of the things that we obviously think of with communication is speech. So I have our system model of a user here, or a person. And what different things can go wrong with speech? Producing speech. Now, you know I like you to talk, so. You know what it can be? Yeah, Marissa.
They may not be able to control their tongue or their mouth in an appropriate way to form the words so people can understand.
So they can have a problem with motor control. That's one place where things could break down in producing speech. Any other places things can break down in the production of speech?
They might forget the names of different objects.
Okay, in the memory or cognition?
You could have aphasia.
Okay, and aphasia would be one diagnosis for forgetting names. So I tend to forget names and nouns occasionally and don't necessarily have an aphasia. Let's see, here's 3. Actually, I didn't put aphasia on this one. I think it's on the next slide.
Yes.
Someone's looking ahead at my slide. Not fair. Okay, we have problems that can happen with the motor control and coordination, which is the dysarthria. I have these all spelled out. So, for apraxia, this is caused by a central nervous system problem. And it mostly prevents the coordination of the peripheral muscles and getting all the different muscles that we use to talk, produce the air that blows over the vocal cords, get the vocal cords vibrating at just the right time, get our mouth and lips in the right, and tongue especially, in the right coordination to produce intelligible speech. So if you have a problem in there, you've got apraxia. Dysarthria can happen from damage either in the central or peripheral nervous system. And that has a combination of weakness, slowness, and some in coordination of all those muscles that have to work together again. And then you can just have a flat-out damaged vocal system where you have some damage to the tongue, some damage to the mouth, or the vocal cords. And those can create a speech impairment as well. So what kind of things can go wrong with understanding speech? Our same person here. Your aphasia is one of the ones I put on this slide, though you're correct in that there can be productive aphasia, which is producing the speech, and also receptive aphasia, which is understanding the speech.
Is it Wernicke's aphasia? That's the first name they want to know.
Say again?
Wernicke's.
Wernicke's aphasia is damage to Wernicke's area of the brain. It's actually, I think that one goes with the understanding, because that's the connections from the hearing area of the brain to the rest of the brain.
So what are aphasias?
Well, an aphasia is a problem either in the perception, where you're not perceiving things right. An aphasia basically is a difficulty in understanding or producing speech that is caused by brain damage. I have an uncle who has an aphasia, and it has very much confused the doctors when he was a kid in the late 1940s, that they'd take him to one doctor, and the doctor would sound a tuning fork in his ear, and he'd look around and said, well, he can hear fine. I don't know what your problem is. Why are you bringing him to me? They'd take him to another doctor. The doctor would talk to him, and he wouldn't understand or respond. And they'd say, well, he's deaf. You know, what are you bringing him to me for? Because he can hear. He can play the piano. But he cannot understand speech. That part of his brain that turns sounds into symbols, I guess, into intelligible words, is damaged. And it's actually kind of interesting. I when I talk with neurologists every once in a while, I will talk to them and describe my uncle, because they are all very interested. Well, you mean he can write, and he can play the piano, and he can read, but he can't understand the spoken word. Well, that means it's probably damaged right in this part. It's a very small lesion, and they get very fascinated. So, now I amuse the doctors every once in a while by describing them. So, in understanding the speech, you can have a receptive aphasia that is where the perception damage in that perceptual parts of the brain that are involved in hearing and translating what is heard into something meaningful. You can also have an expressive aphasia where you can still produce the words fine. The coordination works well, but maybe you can't remember the words, or maybe the words that you remember as having a particular meaning are not the words that everyone else who speaks your language remember as having that same meaning. There's a fascinating Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode called Babel, I think, where everyone came down with expressive aphasia. Due to some virus. But it was one of these conditions where it can be very frustrating because you know what you want to say. You may even only have the expressive form of aphasia, so you can understand what everyone else is saying fine. But you can't produce speech. You can't get anyone else to understand what you're saying that makes perfect sense to you. And either there's something wrong with everyone else or there's something wrong with you. Other things that can go wrong with understanding speech, I put deafness up here even though we aren't going to talk about it today. We'll talk about deafness when we talk about other sensory impairments. Your expressive aphasia can be forgetting vocabulary. It can be not being able to put things together into a sentence that has forgetting basically the rules of grammar and the rules of sentence structure that are appropriate for the language that you're speaking. cause speech impairments. Rebecca already kind of did this list, so I have a few here. Our lists are not identical. I guess you didn't get at the computer late enough last night that I'd already posted this. So what kinds of speech impairments would these different conditions cause? Have you read enough about them in your handbook of severe disabilities that you know what kind of problems might happen?
Cerebral palsy could be spasticity could be a problem.
Okay. Can bring the dysarthria or the apraxia. Getting coordination, getting any coordination can be very difficult with cerebral palsy. And much as we're pretty skilled at it, speech is a very coordinated function. You think how much earlier we learn to walk than we learn to speak. It doesn't take that much coordination to stand up and walk around, but to produce all these complex sounds. Let's see, degenerative diseases, that's a big category. I have ALS as one example, but often what you have there is you have muscle weakness or respiratory weakness so that you can't produce the airflow. Or don't have enough strength in the muscles to be able to produce intelligent sounds. Traumatic brain injury can do just about anything, depending on what part of the brain you injure. Stroke also can produce aphasias, can produce apraxia, can produce any kind of a variety of different deficits. What about high-level spinal cord injury? I know you've read about that. Either that or you completely skipped the readings, in which case you should have read about that.
If you don't have diaphragm control, you can't get the airflow.
Okay, mostly it would be an airflow problem. It takes a very high level spinal cord injury to, basically you have to get injury into the brainstem to get to the actual nerves that control the mouth and tongue. But you can take out all the breathing muscles with a much lower level spinal cord injury. And cancer can do a variety of things as well. That's one source in which you can often get the vocal, damage to the vocal system. You'll see people who've had cancer of the larynx and will have had their larynx removed, so they don't have vocal cords. They're actually little devices. Yeah, Jackie?
Oh, what about if they were brain tumors? Would that ever affect, like, parts?
It depends where the brain tumor is. But it wouldn't fall under traumatic brain injury. But it would be a brain injury, yeah. So you can have a brain tumor that's pressing on any of the nerves that control anything or any of the speech centers. Pressing on or invading, depending on how nasty a brain tumor you happen to have. With the cancer, if you've had a laryngectomy, you don't have the vocal cords. And they will have devices that you can like press against your neck and it will create the vibration. You end up with a very mechanical sounding voice, but you have an artificial vibration for the vocal cords. And then you can still shape your mouth and your tongue to produce mostly intelligible speech.
I saw someone using that. It's pretty neat.
Sounds a
little
bit like
Darth Vader
sometimes.
Yeah, a lot like. At first, I didn't even realize that she was talking. I thought I was looking around to see where the sound was coming from, a machine or something.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are all sorts of other. This is by no means an exhaustive list. So let's look at the definition here. Augmentative and alternative communication, which we will henceforth call AAC because it takes too long to say augmentative and alternative communication. What does it mean to augment something? Yeah.
To like add additional like functionality or to add something that's, you know, to what's already there.
Okay. So to enhance or to add to something. What about alternative? Okay, different from the norm. You're replacing something, essentially. So let's see. To augment, to make greater, or to increase. And alternative is a choice between things. I think I was reading my Webster's Dictionary again. So it's important when we're looking at assistive technology for communication that we rely on both of these. We want to have, we want to augment the person's whatever ability they have. And it would be very rare to find someone who has absolutely no ability to communicate. Now, the communication may be very limited. It may be facial expressions. It may be shaking their head or eye blinks for yes and no. But there's some, usually some communicative ability that a person will have. And you want to utilize that in the situations you can. However, you also want to provide alternatives if the person wants to become as fully functional as possible. And Rebecca gave us a very nice overview of lots of different devices. And actually, there are some that I'm familiar with, like the one that's going to be demoed that you didn't get. But that's because there's like stacks and stacks of these devices. I think communication devices may be one of the most varied devices, because it's one that some engineer will have a child with a disability who can't speak and not really have a connection to the assistive technology that's available, not know what's out there, and come up with something themselves to solve their child's problem. And then, of course, their friends hear about it who also didn't know about the assistive technology, and they start a little company, and then they suddenly hear about ResNa or one of these organizations, and they go and to try to sell their wonderful product that's going to solve everybody's problems and find out that there's actually quite a few products out there already. And some of the companies survive and some of them don't. But there tend to be a lot of little devices that do very similar things, but have been come up with by different people. Augmented and alternative communication is typically used to refer to communication that uses something other than the person's own body for communication. However, to really be effective, you often want to use a multimodal communication. So you want to use communication that combines different aspects. You know, if all you want to say is no, you really don't want to rely on your Pathfinder and typing in the right buttons. If you want to express to someone that whatever they just gave you to eat you really didn't like, there are far more efficient ways than typing out, "I did not like what I just ate." Probably a face will express it far more clearly and far more efficiently than using the device. So whenever possible, you want to incorporate gestures and devices and different levels of technology, like we talked about earlier, from the very high tech to the very low tech, to meet all the different needs that a person's going to have. So let's stop and think for a minute again. Who do you talk to?
People you live with.
Can you talk to people you live with?
Your family or your roommates or...
Family, roommates, people who see you every day and know you very well. Jack?
People in like commercial type settings at a store or a restaurant or something like that where they don't know you, so they're not...
Talk to strangers often who are supposed to be in a position to serve you, but...
questionable.
Whose definitions of service vary from yours at times. Yeah.
Co-workers and fellow students.
Okay, acquaintances, co-workers, fellow students, people that you see often enough, but who don't know what your favorite kind of ice cream is.
Teachers.
And teachers who also don't know what your favorite kind of ice cream is. Let's see, what did I put on my list? Family and close friends. Acquaintances, for example, teachers. Strangers. And your communication system is what you need for communication system is going to be different for different people. Rebecca had a picture of Mary ordering at Wendy's. chances are reasonably good that people who knew her well, the people she lived with, her close family and friends, could understand her. But it was the people, you know, the person behind the counter at Wendy's doesn't have the experience, and you'll find this when you have professors who have an accent sometimes. At the first day, you can't understand them. By the third day, you're starting to get tuned in there, and you can, most of the time, follow if you're awake what they're saying. You know, your ear gets tuned into a particular accent. I would find this when I went to Kenya, that they speak English, but there's a very distinct accent. And if people talked slowly, I was okay. If they talked quickly, especially if they talked quickly on a telephone, I would get lost very easily. But my ear wasn't yet tuned into that accent, and I wasn't there long enough to get really tuned in. So what you may need is a communication system for an unfamiliar partner. You may just get in your way with a familiar partner. You may be able to communicate far more efficiently with your familiar partner, familiar communication partner, that is. What you'll find, actually, is that sometimes when we have someone come in for an evaluation for AAC, they'll bring someone with them to translate for them, because they can make sounds. And if we've worked with a person two or three times, we usually learn to translate. There can also be similarities in the way different people, you know, the accent that people have, depending on whether they have apraxia or dysarthria. But at first, it's very useful to have that person who is very familiar with them to translate for them. It's also the caregiver who has an opinion on what's going to be used as well. You also may find that the communication system is needed for complex concepts. Like, gee, let's plan a vacation. Where do we want to go? What do we want to see? What kind of timing do we want to use? Versus very simple concepts like I do or do not like what I just had. Perhaps what do we want to watch on TV? That can be relatively simple communication based on yes and no. And you can get a lot of that with gestures or facial expressions. There's different types of communication. Rebecca kind of hit this. There's conversation, and there's all sorts of communication that can get lumped into the graphical communication. Writing being very different, actually, from, even though it's the same language, writing is very different in a formal sense from conversation. Now, the advent of email has blurred that somewhat, in that we treat email as a conversation and ignore all the formal rules of writing. But one thing I'm doing on your papers is going through and circling all the contractions, because you don't use contractions in formal writing the way you would use in conversation or an email, or standing up in front of you saying you don't do that. Mathematics is a very complex form of written communication. And if you've taken your differential equations or your calculus, it has all sorts of weird symbols. And for that matter, if you're just doing your simple, you know, first grade addition, you write backwards from what you write when you're writing English. I don't know if you ever thought of that. And then drawing and plotting is an entirely different form of graphical communication, which can be very efficient, but it requires a very different set of skills. Yeah.
What do you mean you write backwards?
Yeah. Do you mean that you write vertically instead of horizontally?
If you're writing, they didn't seem to leave me an eraser today, but if I'm going to add up some numbers, where do I start when I add?
You compute backwards. Okay, I'm with it.
Okay. So here, I better put my first number here. And then I got to pop up here and carry something. And so while I wrote these left to right, I'm writing my answer right to left. So if you've ever tried to do mental arithmetic in your head and then write the answer down in Microsoft Word or something, either you end up doing the whole thing in your head and then writing the answer down, or you end up writing this and spacing over with the arrow keys to get to where you want to put the next number. And it's an awkward form of writing. It can be very difficult if you're a child who is just starting to understand addition. And suddenly you have to deal with, not only do I have to learn the addition, but I've got to make the computer that I'm using to do my written work backwards. And for that matter, work backwards down here, but not up here. Yes?
I have a question about that last slide of types of communication. I would think it would kind of be an issue also with nonverbal communication. I kind of feel like, I don't know, like probably a third of the things that I communicate to people are just with gestures. And if I didn't have that ability, like motor control or otherwise, like a lot would get lost. Is there ever a case where you try to compensate for that?
You can try to compensate. It's, now a lot of people who can't speak or don't speak, like my uncle has a few words that people who know him well can understand. But for the most part, he doesn't speak. He can be an excellent mime, though, and can communicate a lot with gestures. He tells jokes sometimes with pantomime. Now, he is essentially, except for a little arthritis, fully functional, except for his aphasia. You can certainly get some eye pointing, gesturing, facial expression can often be very much enhanced in someone who doesn't have other forms of communication that are efficient. You know, they develop what skills they have into more efficient communication. But the simple pointing, some people will be able to do that, some people won't. Some people will point with their chin or their eyes or something. And that can work very well with the familiar partner. It's harder to do with the unfamiliar partner. Though you may have your communication device programmed with some of those phrases that we'll try to substitute for the pointing device. Over on my right. Yeah.
Would someone with an aphasia be able to, I guess they would be able to communicate with like sign language?
Depends on the aphasia. If, in my uncle's case, yes, he actually was educated in a school for the deaf because they could teach him American Sign Language and knew how to deal with someone who you couldn't talk to and had them respond. So if you have a massive aphasia, that would translate American Sign Language could be damaged as well. He apparently had a fairly small area that was damaged, and actually at a very young age. And that is an incredibly important thing in the brain, how young you were when a damage occurred. Because the brain really doesn't stop developing until you're in your teens. Which, I don't know, studying the brain is just a fascinating area. I know very little of what is known about it, but I know enough to know that what is known about it is very little of what there is to know. So, I give people some very nice complex things to transcribe there. See, so when we talk about how fast do we talk, how fast do we communicate? Speech, when we're talking conversation, they claim is about 150 to 175 words per minute. If you're typing, they claim you can get up to 100 words per minute if you are really good at typing. Now, I've only gotten up to like 70 when I'm taking a typing test. There are certainly things that I type faster than that. I can type my name and password very quickly. I can type the name of the computer I typically log into very quickly. You know, so there are certain things that my fingers have learned just to whip through. And my mom claims that I type faster than 70 words a minute, but you know, it's hard to do that on a test, on a typing test. If you actually have to decide what you're going to type at the same time, it really slows you down. We say about 50 words per minute. If you're only a one-finger typist, people claim 10 to 12 words per minute. Now, I think there are one-finger typists who go faster than that. If you're going through a scanning system, you're actually doing pretty good if with letter-by-letter scanning to get up to 3 to 5 words per minute. And that kind of brings up the question, how fast do you have to communicate before people will stop engaging you in conversation, or will just get bored waiting for the next thing you're going to say and wander away? You know, it's a, how efficient does your communication have to be in order to be functional? And there's been a little bit of research about that. If you start dropping below 3 or 4 words a minute, you're really going to have trouble keeping the attention of your user. I mean, I have trouble concentrating on what my uncle is trying to communicate, because he'll write out, he carries this little pad of paper around. It's his primary augmentative communication device, is pen and paper. But you know, he'll be writing out something, and while he's writing it, I either have the choice of looking over his shoulder, which isn't always possible, or I'm sitting waiting for the several sentences he's about to say, and my attention wanders. And I'm not meaning to be disrespectful or anything, but my attention wanders. And so then, you know, he'll be done writing, and then I'll read through what he said, and it'll be my turn to write something down. But, you know, how quickly, how much attention do you have, and how much patience do you have to wait for that communication? So efficiency can be a very important thing. We should think about what we do, all the different skills that are needed for communication. It can be difficult to evaluate if someone has them. And if you are working with a child, chances are reasonably good they don't have all of them. I really haven't met that many 2-year-olds who have all the skills that are necessary for communication. And if that's when you're called in for a 2 or 3 or 4-year-old who doesn't seem to be developing speech, but you need to provide them with a communication system, well, how can you evaluate? You've got to figure out what exactly is the desired function. Someone's coming in, we want this person to be able to communicate. Well, communicate what, with whom, in what environment, how quickly, what's the vocabulary? There are a lot of questions to be answered there. What are we going to use to control the interface? We've talked about control interfaces. You have some idea of that. But you have to have a control interface that the person can operate efficiently, but you want it to be as fully functional as possible. Do they have the cognitive and language skills to really use a communication system? How complex can you make the system and they'll still be able to use it? For that matter, do they understand the concept that the things that they do affect the world and can control the communication system? Do they understand language when it's spoken to them? To a certain sense, it's very easy to provide a device that will speak for a person. It's much harder to do. Provide a device that will provide the comprehension for a person if they don't get it themselves. You know, there's a few things you can do with helping the sensory, but mostly if you have that perceptual aphasia, receptive aphasia, what you're going to end up doing is teaching people strategies, teaching them to use a picture board, point to what you want to tell me, teaching them strategies around it. and then what experience and what skills do they have in producing language themselves? Do they initiate conversations? Are they able to use the word prediction or other shortcut rate enhancement methods in producing their language? Lots of different things you can say. You can have a simple yes, no. It's a good thing to have. I have tried on occasion to have that as the first set of communication things that you set up for someone. Stand between the yes and the no, which one do you want? I really don't think that's a great idea, because I think that's a pretty boring set to be choosing from, especially if you're working with a child for initial communication. Gestures can be communication, and your yes, no is also up there in, that may be a communication that the person has that they can do themselves, and they don't need a device for. Can you produce sounds? Can you work with the low-tech? You can give us lots of nice examples of low-tech. You can either point, you can also have, use eye gaze to select which of the pictures is the person looking at on a letter board or a picture board. Sometimes they'll do it with a big, clear plastic thing, and then the different pictures you can see through, and the communication partner stands on the other side so they can see kind of where the person is looking in that kind of a setup. Then you have all sorts of different high-tech stuff. Have all sorts of different input methods, back to my control interfaces. Switches, a keyboard, which is basically a whole bunch of switches. Eye-gaze systems, either with a partner looking at where your eyes are pointing, or some very complex eye-gaze systems that use cameras to pick up where your eyes are looking. There's even ones that will try to look at the activity of the occipital lobe and your visual cortex to pick up which thing you're looking at. And then any other type of control interface that we've talked about. Another question for you. Can you use voice input to a communication system?
Maybe with different languages.
Okay, different languages would work.
Maybe.
Of course, we could get that one really working, we'd make a fortune.
You could understand some things your uncle says. You could have some computer that would understand those same things and translate them into what the real thing was.
And repeat them in a clearer voice,
yeah.
Definitely. Sometimes a person's communication system will just be a microphone and an amplifier that they can talk, but unless you have a microphone right up against their face, you can't really hear it, especially if you're in a noisy environment. I met someone at one of my conferences who used a system like that, and it was kind of odd at first talking to him because I could see that he was talking, but this was in an exhibit hall. So there were, overhead speakers making announcements. There were people all around talking. And it took me a while to tune in to what he was saying because it sounded like it was coming over a speaker. It was coming over a speaker, what I was hearing. But, I was trying to concentrate on what he was saying, and I was consciously trying to tune out the mechanically produced sounds around me. And it took me a minute to focus and say, he is mechanically producing the sound that I'm trying to hear. We got it. So, why do we talk with each other? Spend a little more time talking about the, what would you need to put into a communication device? And we've got four categories that your book covers. You communicate to express things that you need or want. I'm hungry. I need some food. I need to go to the bathroom. I really need that Nike shoes because otherwise people will think I'm not cool. maybe that goes into the wants, but information transfer. And we've been doing a lot of that today. And that's certainly something that, you know, Stephen Hawking uses his communication system for, where he's going around giving lectures on the nature of the universe and quantums and quarks and all these words that I basically know in general what they are, but really have little understanding of. But far more simple things can be information transfer. What happened at school today? You know, those kinds of conversations are fairly common. The social closeness is always a fun one. And I think if you're working with kids, that may be the place to start, is communication that will express social closeness. If you think about what do little kids say to each other when they meet?
Hi.
Okay, say hi. You see a friend, if they're with a friend, you know, did you see that episode of, what would it be, Pokemon now? I don't know what all the phrases are from Pokemon. I know we had communication systems that we would program with Calabunga dudes or, you know, Go Team USA or, you know, just the phrases the kids will pick up from their social groups, the things that it's really cool to be able to say and makes other kids look at you as part of their group or someone they can play with and interact with. Even if there's not much information transfer going on, it creates a bond. We usually think of the social etiquette things, the hi, hello, excuse me, pardon me, please, thank you. Those we think of easily. But the social closeness things, adults, I think, tend to kind of skim over. We ignore them as a need. And I think when you're starting with a child, that can be a very real need in their world and much more motivating than, I need to go to the bathroom. When you start wanting to teach conversation to a child, they have a lot of different things that they have to learn. Have to learn that you take turns when you're conversing. When someone speaks to you, you say something back to them. And my mom always described it as you have to throw the ball back to them and play and catch with this conversational ball. And I hated that one. That lecture. You need to learn how to initiate a conversation. How do you get someone's attention? This is something that kids spend a lot of time learning. Now, how do I get mom's attention when she's talking to someone without making her mad at the same time? That goes with the appropriate methods of interrupting as well. How do you go up to someone and start talking to them if they're not talking to anyone else? How do you interrupt someone who is talking and get yourself into the conversation or interrupt them and say, you know, no, you didn't understand what I meant. Or, sorry, I hit the wrong button on this communication device. I didn't say what I meant. Or any number of, you know, how do you repair a problem that's occurred in the conversation? How do you keep a conversation going? If you talk on the phone to someone and they're telling you a long story, how do you keep the conversation going? Uh-huh. Yeah, I see. That can be hard to generate on a communication system. They actually have communication systems that will be set up with just, you know, a one button that would generate randomized different, these kind of continuation sounds, because they serve an important role in our society. And you don't always want to be saying exactly the same thing, but at the same time, I would want to be careful that there weren't any in my randomized loop that were very strong affirmative agreements. Because sometimes I don't agree with what the person is saying at all, but I feel like I'm supposed to make some sound so that they know I'm still on the phone or whatever. You find that in conversation with people who can't produce speech at this 150 to 175 words a minute or whatever I'm talking at, that they'll use telegraphic speech. So a speech that's very much like if you see the old movies where they're reading a telegram, you know, arrived, six, stop. You just put the most important words in there and the ones that convey the actual meaning and leave out all the little ones that make it sound smooth. There are also people working on systems where you put in the telegraphic speech and it will fill in the rest of the sentence structure and put in all the thes and those little words that make things smooth for people. Very difficult to select vocabulary. We can talk about that a little more next time. They say you need a minimum of 200 words for adult conversation, but what any one given person is going to want to say is very individualized, not just based on who they are, but also what situations they're going to be in. All sorts of different rate enhancement things. You can certainly store whole words or phrases, grabber sentences to get people's attention. You can predict what person's trying to type. You can expand on vocabularies. Talked a little last time about how you could have word morphologies, put different endings on a word that you've already selected, and different forms of the words. Lots of different writing. Note-taking can be very difficult with the communication system. And just different types of writing. I can slide some of this into the next time because I need to leave the rest of the time to demonstrate a device for us here. So, and also, we talked a little bit about the different directions that cursors move when you're writing. And when you're doing a communication system or a computer program, to allow people to use these things. That can be very important. And you need to train absolutely everybody, preferably in the environment it's going to be used in, and provide the training in the kind with the kind of interactions that the person is likely to be using the system for, not in just a you talk to me, to kind of get other people in there to talk to the person. And they tend to find that there are certain groups of people who get good services. You know, children who have cerebral palsy, so some very obvious physical disability, but have good cognition, good cognitive abilities, tend to get well served. People who, or children who have basically normally functioning bodies but can't communicate, tend to be very underserved. Because they don't get into the right label or the right programs. And then, of course, aphasias and brain injuries and strokes can be very difficult. Can cause very difficult problems to deal with and things that people just don't get. You know, how often do you see grandma getting speech-language therapy after her stroke or something? And we will pick this up next time.